Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Disruption has become a buzzword and apt descriptor for economic life in the past generation, and according to two studies published this year, it'll only get worse over the next decade. In a March 2017 study, PricewaterhouseCoopers estimated that 38% of American jobs would be eliminated by 2030, and a just-released study from McKinsey predicts up to a third of the American workforce idled by that same date. The culprit? Robotics and artificial intelligence. The vulnerable occupations, those involved in data collection, processing, and predictable physical work, according to McKinsey. So why proceed with AI given that much future economic disruption, plus more existential warnings from thinkers ranging from Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking to Henry Kissinger? According to my guest today, AI is already around us, mostly affecting our lives for the better, and technology never stops developing. If Americans rein in AI development, he says, especially generalized AI that involves human-like thinking, some other world player will fill the gap with potential catastrophic effects in national security, business, and influence building. Amir Hussain is an inventor and entrepreneur and founder and CEO of Speak Cognition, a leading AI software firm, and he's the author of The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. It's published by Scribner, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Amir Hussain, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rich, for having me. I appreciate it.
There are a lot of really smart people like Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, and Bill Gates who say we should be wary of the future development of artificial intelligence. Of course, there are equally smart people that say we should embrace this technology, and you are one of the latter. So why should we not fear this new technology, which seems to have, well, I mean, it's getting close to where in the future AI could be sentient?
Well, you know, there's two approaches to sort of address that question. And one of them is sort of philosophical, and that's something that I cover in detail in the book. I think that creating artificial intelligence is really an expression of our own human capability to build things that can then in turn exhibit creativity of their own. And I think there's no greater aspiration for a creator than to be able to build things like that. And that's sort of an argument that, you know, we see vignettes of that in religious texts, and I use some of those examples in the book as well. But then there's a very practical kind of a response as well. And the practical response is the reason we shouldn't really fear it or try to stop it is because we can't stop it. We've never been able to stop technology. When you reach a certain point, innovation just happens. Invention just happens. And I also give examples of this in the book where, for example, you know, the Nobel Prize has been won by physicists who, not even knowing each other, were working on the same problem in completely disconnected parts of the world. And this is something that we see in human history. I don't think most people believe that fire was invented by one person or the process to start a fire was invented by one person and then shared with everybody else. Obviously, it was something that was quote-unquote invented or discovered in various parts of the world at different times by different people. So, you know, this whole idea of human society as a whole uncovering newness, innovation, new ideas, and technology and science speaks to the inevitability of science. And I believe in that. I believe that if Albert Einstein did not exist, that we would still have a theory of special relativity and a theory of general relativity. It may have been decades after Einstein, and that's not to take away from the man's brilliance, but I do believe in the inevitability of innovation and technology. So at a practical level, I don't think it would make a difference. I think what would make a difference is focusing our efforts at the right time on capabilities and technologies and techniques that can bring about a safe transition to artificial intelligence. So within AI, for example, there's entire areas of research, safe AI, explainable AI. Those are areas that we should really truly invest in. And my own work has been focused in part in some of those areas.
You know, if I can get back to that first idea, the philosophical thing, you know, when we think of how humans have affected other lives, and that could be everything from developing food stocks that are easier to grow, more resistant to pestilence or famine, or animal species, you know, whether it's developing bigger horses to carry plows or dogs for specialized purposes, they're all there to make human life easier. I think the fear is that with AI, at some point, we may be answering to machines instead of machines answering to humans. Do you share any of that fear?
Well, look, it can't be dismissed, but it's a very distant fear. I mean, the reality is that I'm an AI researcher. We build real systems that use AI to solve problems in the real world. And based on everything that I know and everything that I've seen, I don't think that artificial general intelligence, you know, AI at the level of, say, a human practitioner across general areas is going to happen next Thursday. I think that we're still ways away from that. And along this path, and I think, by the way, it's a worthwhile goal to be able to create technology that can solve a number of problems for us and think generally. I think that's a worthwhile goal. However, in pursuing that goal, I think we have the latitude and we have time if we focus our energies and we focus our research interests and put some capital behind these problems. Is again, like I said, the development of safe and explainable AI. Now, coming back to your more existential question, of course, which is that so far, you know, everything that we've done has been to make our lives better. And if we create AI, will that be a break from this tradition of technology for man's sake? That's a very deep question. I think over time, I mean, one of the things that's pretty clear is that even today, while the human condition in some measurable ways has improved, if you think about human development indicators and longevity and things like that, it's improved. At another level, which is the sort of question of why am I even here, we don't really have an answer that's much better than the answer that the Greeks were able to come up with, or various different, you know, religious philosophers over the last several millennia have been able to come up with. And to me, again, this is one aspect that I'm very interested in, and I talk about this in the book. If you think about this from the point of view of existential nihilism, you know, Camus and other existential nihilists, they talked about sort of this idea that purpose isn't pre-programmed, right? In my words, I like to use the word programmed because when we come into this world, we bring something with us. And science tells us that that's through genes, and you know, other traditions maybe ascribe other vehicles that allow us access to that knowledge. But we bring something with us, and when we bring, that inheritance with us into this world, is purpose part of that inheritance? Do we come here with a purpose, or do we find our own purpose? And increasingly, at least my own view, is that one of the challenges, in fact, for us, for individual human beings as well as us as a species, is to find that higher purpose. And I look at the pursuit of artificial intelligence even more philosophically in that light. I think that exhibiting our talents, enhancing our talents as innovators, developers, creators, inventors, is worthwhile because it's a furtherance of the pursuit of knowledge. And I believe the pursuit of knowledge is a higher purpose. And that's something that we have to find when we enter this life. We have to find that purpose. But artificial intelligence is not delinked from that. It's not something different. It is progression along the path of the search for knowledge. And in that respect, I think that it's incredibly worthwhile and something that we as a species, as the human race, should certainly commit ourselves to.
Let's take a step back for a moment. You referred to generalized AI or generalized artificial intelligence versus narrow AI, and you do a great deal of discussion of the difference. Narrow AI, from what I can see, we're surrounded by all the time. When we're talking about the future of AI, we're talking about this idea of generalized AI, which is intelligence that more mimics sentient thinking. Is that a quick definition of the difference?
Yes. So artificial narrow intelligence is what we have now. For example, we have artificial intelligence programs that can defeat human grandmasters at the game of Go or the game of chess. However, if you ask that artificial intelligence to then drive a car or fly a plane, it can't do that. It's specialized in a certain narrow field. And in that narrow field, it can outperform a human expert. Artificial general intelligence is usually referred to as sort of general purpose intelligence like what human beings have. It's amazing that our minds can adapt to so many different fields of expertise. We can be athletically, we can be great. We can write poetry and fly a plane all within the same brain. You know, that's pretty amazing. And so that kind of general capability is what we're looking to build and what we're looking to replicate with machines. And yes, that is referred to as artificial general intelligence. Now, there's this idea of the intelligence explosion, which is that, you know, once machines achieve the capability to have mastery over diverse fields of expertise and achieve artificial general intelligence, then from that point on, you know, they can run faster, more of them can be spawned, all of the advantages that you see with machines, ease of replication, etc., all of those can be exercised to build one that's slightly better. Because along with other general traits, one of the traits that this AGI would have is the ability to master the field of artificial intelligence. So it becomes this sort of recursive process where one creates something slightly better than the other, and then that slightly better model creates something that's slightly better than it, and that continues, and the speed at which that can unfold is radical, and that's referred to as the intelligence explosion, and what that would result in is what's sometimes in literature referred to as artificial superintelligence, or a level of intelligence that's far, far beyond human intelligence.
Mm. Now, one of the things you talked about earlier was this safe transition to an AI future, which is, I think, what the people who say we should be wary of this development are also talking about. What are some of the key points to keep in mind in making a safe transition to a future in which AI plays a greater role in virtually every field of the workplace and the home place, for that matter?
So the two big, I think, axes that we have to sort of keep in mind, one is connected to the existential fear of AI will take all our jobs away and it'll undermine the economy the way that it's set up today. And the other axis is connected with this idea of AI will kill me, you know, AI will sort of take over the world. And so those are the two big existential fears. And by the way, they can't be diminished. Very smart people have expressed these fears, and they are grounded in some rational thought. So, but let's take each one of those. In the case of AI undermining the economy, one of the common answers that I hear is, oh, don't worry about it. This is just a transition to another form of technology. And when we do that, there'll be other jobs that we haven't even thought of that'll come about. And all the people that are displaced because of this technology transition, we'll find room for them in those new yet unknown jobs. While some of that is true, of course, over time, we do discover new fields of endeavor. And those fields of endeavor then lead to gainful employment for people. 200 years ago, you couldn't imagine that software developer was going to be a profession, but it is, and millions are employed in pursuing that work. So some of that will happen. But at the same time, I don't think that we're headed into a future where everyone that is displaced by AI, for each such job, there will be one more job created. And the reason I say that is because with the steam engine in the late 1600s, we replicated human muscle. And the exercise of muscle in construction or exploration or travel or any of these things that traditionally human muscle was used for is limited today. Now we're at the cusp of being able to replicate the human mind. And basically, that's what man is, muscle and mind. And so when we replicate the mind, or we come pretty close to replicating the mind, at least insofar as having the capability to fulfill sort of these economic labors, then sort of if you think about that, what's left, right? And so I think we have to grapple with this reality that we need to rewrite the social contract, and we need to think about those things now. It's a good thing. Our technology has brought us to a point where we can take care of the populace, the population of this world, and so we should. And there are ways that we don't have a final answer on this, of course, but there are ways that are being proposed that would allow us to leverage this technology to improve the standard of living and allow people the choice to do things beyond what the traditional sort of professions and the traditional output of economic labor, the way we've defined it so far, have led to. So I think there's opportunity there. But in order to really take advantage of it, we have to start talking. We have to start figuring out policy. We have to start figuring out what that renewed social contract will be.
My guest today is Amir Hussain. He's the inventor and entrepreneur and founder and CEO of Spark Cognition, a leading artificial intelligence specializing in cognitive software. And he's the author of The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. It's published by Scribner. Getting back to the job losses, in your book, you quote PricewaterhouseCooper as estimating 38% of American jobs will be eliminated by AI or robotics by 2030. As you well know, McKinsey just came out with a report that suggests a survey of perhaps a third of American jobs eliminated by that same date. And yet, as you talk about this need for this transition, no American politician on the national stage today is talking about the negative effects of this potential future or the remedies to this potential future.
Yeah, I think focusing on the negative is really about, you know, not wanting to do anything about how to truly leverage what is a huge opportunity. So it's negative if you're not prepared to take advantage of it, but it's not negative otherwise. And of course, you need committed policymakers. You need, you know, right-thinking individuals having this debate, including the general population, the citizens in this debate, and then figuring out and charting a course forward. And I'll tell you what, we don't have an option. And I say that because you may have read also that China has just announced a five-year AI program. They're looking to be the world leader in AI by 2030. They've set themselves that target, which is just a short 12 years away. And they have committed $150 billion in governmental spend on artificial intelligence over the next 5 years. Contrast that with U.S. government spending on AI in 2015 of $1.1 billion, and in 2016 of 1.2, 150, right, versus a fraction of that, versus $1 billion a year, basically. And so our near-peer competitors are headed in this direction anyway. And even though China still enjoys relatively these labor cost advantages from an economic perspective, they are roboticizing at a faster rate than we are. So at the end of it, we can either talk about the pitfalls and the problems and woe is us, or we can prepare for a future that, by the way, won't ask us if it's going to come around. It's going to come around anyway, and that goes back to the inevitability of technology and the inevitability of scientific progress. So we have an option, which is to take advantage of the opportunity. But I think just focusing on the negatives does no one any favors.
Well, let's focus on some of the positives. You outline a wide range of positives, everything from the medical world in which, you know, you could see AI used in the quick diagnosis of illnesses or maladies that cause doctors to shake, you know, scratch their head and order battery and battery of tests to figure out what's wrong. You're talking about in the business world, military security and business security. Can you give us a few of the benefits of this coming AI world?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, let's start with healthcare. You know, within healthcare, there are so many illnesses that, you know, there are these bucket terms for symptoms, and most people think that that's an illness. For example, in the book, I share that I suffer from cluster headaches. Now, most people listening to this will think that it's just another form of headache or might be a bad headache. It's actually about the most extreme form of pain that you can experience. It's absolutely terrible. In fact, cluster headaches max out the pain receptors in your brain most of the time, and colloquially it's referred to as a suicide headache. It's terrible, right? You wouldn't wish this on anyone. And yet at the same time, cluster headache is not really an illness. It's a set of symptoms which might be related to multiple issues. It might be genetic causes, it might be environmental causes, it might be something else. Who knows? It might be seven different forms of headache that all masquerade under the same symptom. And today, if you focus medical research, you're going to focus it on issues that most people suffer from or a larger number of people suffer from. So we actually have shortfalls of human intellect and talent focused on specific areas. There aren't enough people looking into cluster headaches. We don't have an answer yet. And you know what? At some level, even though I personally suffer from them, I understand, because we have to focus our resources on the greatest ills. And in that, however, there is a lot of long tail of illness, you know, these things that go undiagnosed or get bucketed in these under these terms, might be seven illnesses masquerading as one, as I said. And that those are some of the areas where AI as a sort of decoder for a lot of these symptoms can help. And I cover this extensively in the book. That's one example. I'll give you one other, which is in the area of cybersecurity. You know, today, everything is online. It's all, you know, quote unquote, in the cloud. And at the same time, you have massive outbreaks of Trojans and viruses and malware. And now a lot of the developers of this malware have started to use more basic techniques to automate the process of developing the malware. And these techniques will only become more sophisticated over time. So you have tens of thousands of new forms of attacks being evolved on a daily basis. There's just no way that human practitioners can deal with these kinds of outbreaks. There's just no way that as we go into a world of the Internet of Things, where instead of the 4 billion or so phones, laptops, and desktops, we head into a world where there's 100 billion connected devices and soon a trillion connected devices, that 6-7 billion humans are going to be able to defend that kind of footprint. There's just no way. So if we're going to embrace technology, we have to do that with some semblance or idea or assurance of security. And artificial intelligence is really the only viable way for us to get there in the field of cybersecurity. So those are just two examples.
And you mentioned the Internet of Things, and I was reading about that in the book, and I was thinking of, obviously, the self-driving car as an Internet of Things product, but I was thinking that perhaps the Internet of Things is already here, but you're talking about a future date when more and more of, you know, I'm thinking of the sensors in your car that tell you something's going wrong, but you're talking about a more generalized Internet of Things, aren't you?
Yeah, absolutely. And if you think about this, again, with two variables in mind, one is sort of volume, how many of these things are out there, and the second is capability, what can they do? Across both of those variables, today where we are is that we have some 100 million, couple billion, single-digit billion Internet-connected devices, depending on whether you want to include your phones and laptops and desktops or just purely, you know, IoT embedded devices. But nonetheless, numbers are relatively small. As a larger number of these systems come online, what they can do just by virtue of the increase in volume, those capabilities will be amplified. And what I mean by this is if your sprinkler is internet connected and you've got weather updates coming in also to an internet connected device and your Alexa is internet connected and you've got home automation and thermostats that are also interconnected, the interplay of all of that leads to capabilities that any one internet connected device can't replicate. So literally the fabric of reality starts to get internet connected. Everything is internet connected. And so the interplay of that by virtue of the rise in quantity, by that increase in volume, leads to very interesting capabilities. The other variable, as I mentioned, is just what these things can do. Today, if you think about a Fitbit or you think about, you know, an app on your phone that can measure how many steps you've taken in a day, it's recording data. But there are levels of functionality that go beyond just recording the data. The second step beyond this is where you can make sense of the data and provide recommendations. So, for example, when you're looking down at a plate full of food, there's a camera, maybe embedded in your eyeglasses, that's identifying exactly what kind of food it is. It's estimating how large of a serving it is. It's finding out what kind of allergies you suffer from. It's warning you that this food has a component that might trigger an allergy. Or on a more mundane basis, if you're trying to keep up with a diet, it's estimating the exact number of calories on what you have on your plate at this point in time and giving you advice. So that's one level beyond where we are now. It's not just about recording information. It's about interpreting that information and providing you feedback. And then the third step is what I call actuation, right, which is actually taking these decisions and doing things in the real world, taking action in the real world. And that's when this entire parallel world of internet-connected devices that can all talk to each other and exchange information and interpret information and make decisions, that's when all of this just comes alive because it starts doing things. And that's a future that is not that far away.
Our last couple of minutes, we talked about this earlier, this idea of our purpose in life. And in a world with AI, when more of us are not working in a traditional job, how do we find our purpose? And we've been programmed, as you say, to think of work as our purpose. And one of the things your book talks about is sort of a Star Trek world in which we don't, our purpose is not working our job, it's to live our life. And you spend a great deal of time talking about this idea of decoupling work and purpose.
Absolutely. And if you think about it, you know, today, a lot of the things that we do would not have been considered useful work 200 years ago. Our needs have evolved. For example, you know, if you're working in a factory producing plastic toys, you know, that say Pokemon toys or something like that, I mean, most people 300 years ago would say, well, you're producing what, 3 billion of those? What's the point of that? You know, there's no value in it. It doesn't help you survive. It doesn't help you thrive. It might entertain you, but you do so much just for entertainment. That's so strange. So our norms have kind of evolved over time, right? And so when you think about that future world where what we call work today, what we call being gainfully employed today, that definition is going to continue to evolve, and we need to embrace that. So to think that if you're not producing food or you're not taking care of somebody, you know, as a doctor would, or you're not working in a mill or a factory, then you're useless, or what you're doing is useless. It's just not the way that we have as a society evolved. And in future, there'll be a lot of things that we'll do, one of which is just uncovering more of what I refer to as the ideascape, this infinite landscape of ideas, of unending knowledge and wisdom. And if you have artificial intelligence operating in uncovering the ideascape alongside man, the good news is that the AI might be faster than you, but the landscape ahead is infinite. There are uncountable ideas waiting to be discovered. And in an infinite landscape, speed is no advantage, because you're going to end up discovering an infinitesimally small part of what is possible, and so will something that's operating at a million times faster speed than you. So that's the great equalizer, the infinity of ideas. And I think this whole notion of what we do in future and what we talk about as being gainfully employed, these definitions will continue to shift and evolve as they have over time.
Amir Hussain, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Amir Hussain is the founder and CEO of Speak Cognition, a leading AI software firm, and the author of The Sentient Machine, The Coming Age of Artificial Intelligence. It's published by Scribner's. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.